I'd like to open the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. We are going to open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 222. You could give us a brief summary of where we are so far, Administrator Donovan.
Sure, it'd be a pleasure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 222 aims to broadly expand college-level credit opportunities to high school students throughout the state through a variety of different methods, including some expanded scholarship and grant programs, new requirements for issuance of a high school diploma, and other methods. The committee previously held the public hearing on Tuesday, the 5th of February, and plans to hold a further hearing next Tuesday, the February 26th.
But she gave them to me in a weird way.
Okay, and the dash ones?
Yeah, they're in the packet.
You want to explain those?
Sure. The dash one amendments that are proposed today seek to clarify some of the issues that arose in the in our first hearing on the 5th of February, particularly some issues related to credits and the definition of credits and what is a high school credit and a college level credit and how those hours convert.
Okay, and we had a place on teacher flexibility. All right, so let's call up Morgan Allen, first of all, signed up. And this amendment, you're going to speak to the bill and the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Oregon School Boards Association. And wanted to just come let you know our members are eager to find ways to get kids ready for post-secondary and get kids more opportunities to do AP, IB, and college credits while they're in high school. So we wanted to share our support for language in the dash one amendments that's added in section 8. Our members feel it's critically important that our public school teachers are able to teach college credit-bearing courses in our high schools where the kids are at. And we know there are currently some bureaucratic barriers that prevent this from happening, and these amendments, we think, go a good step towards addressing that issue. I think the other thing that I know there's going to be more hearings on this bill, but as you know, Mr. Chair, COSA and some community college presidents and Deputy Superintendent Saxton have been putting together a work group and I think are getting pretty close to issuing the half dozen or so recommendations that we would encourage the committee to take a look at and see if we can get any of those that we think work into the bill as well. So just wanted to add our support to that, and our members are eager to work with you on the bill.
Thank you. And we will have more and more amendments. I just wanted to get this one out first. It clarifies, I think, some of the issues that Senator Cruz brought up. And we have a couple in the pipeline that weren't quite ready today. First of all, any questions on the amendment or questions to Morgan Allen? Senator Roblin?
Thank you. So basic six quarter credits. So what quarter credits are we talking about? Because, again, it's in the same chapter the same line that says that it takes 24 credits to graduate from high school.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Roblin, I came today to talk about the portion of Section 8, but as you know, there is still some language in here around the high school diploma requirements, which I understand the chair is working on and is taking feedback on. So I believe there may be some changes to that as well.
Okay.
Further questions?
Well, I think this chair is just a matter of making sure we're getting the terminology right.
Okay. Are you senators comfortable in adopting the dash ones?
No. I think what Senator Roblin spoke to, it's still ambiguous, and hopefully the next set of amendments will have the clarification.
Yeah, I'm still worried that if we look at these amendments in that other section, the number of credits you're saying that to graduate from high school, you have to have one full year of high school in post-secondary education.
Yeah.
Because they're the same kind of credits. I mean, we don't have quarter credits in high school. We have credits. And so when you mix the names, it really causes me some real confusion yet.
I think, Mr. Chair, we wait till we have all the I's dotted and all the T's crossed before we even consider amendments.
If you understand, that's my concern.
Okay. All right. Well, we can hold off. We're going to take more swings at this, including one that we thought was going to be ready today, giving some more flexibility to schools and teachers.
I agree with that. I like this part.
It's just not, so why don't we hold off then and do this, I think, next Tuesday? Get this back up again? And then we do have some, as Morgan mentioned, some work from a sort of a loose-knit group that Rob Saxon's been working with.
That'd be great.
Make some really significant changes here, so.
That'd be perfect for me.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I'll close public hearing. I'm sorry, we have anybody else here signed up? Marcia Kelly, I'm so sorry.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. I will probably just defer my testimony until the point that I have access to amendments. I looked on the website. They were not there. The concern that we do have, however, is requiring college credits to graduate from high school. AUW believes strongly in post-secondary education. We fund $4 million a year for women to get masters and PhDs and international women to better themselves by coming to the United States and studying. We don't think that college credits are appropriate for every high school student, and so we do have concerns that there are no other provisions. But I'll wait to see what the next set of amendments have, and I may want to testify on that too.
Well, we hope you do. So thank you. Senator Barr.
I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. You're supportive of the idea of providing the opportunity for dual credit in whatever form, but you're opposed to the idea of requiring it as a high school credit?
Correct.
Okay.
Exactly. Everyone is not ready for college level work, and it's not appropriate for some people. And to say you have a high school diploma only if you have college credit sort of says something about the high school diploma.
I get it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm going to close public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 222, and I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 139, and we're going to change horses here in our administrators and bring up our intern, Ophelia Miller, who's going to assist us in working on this bill. Maybe you could start with, you could give us a brief summary?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 139 allows the Oregon Education Investment Board to authorize the Secretary of State to have access to education records of students in the public education system for auditing purposes.
Okay, thank you. I have a few people signed up here. Let's start with Gary Blackmere.
Thank you, Chair Haas. Members of the committee, my name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the director of the Secretary of State Audits Division. Until this last year, the Federal Education Rights and Privacy Act prohibited auditors from obtaining student information to conduct performance audits. They had access to conduct financial audits to determine compliance with federal rules, but the data could not be used to look at the performance of organizations, how programs were managed, how effective they were, and so we were effectively barred from being able to do this kind of analysis. The rule was changed in this last year, and it required us to obtain permission from an education authority in order to conduct our audits. And what we looked at in this process was that we have been approaching the education system as a system, thinking about students first, and thinking about the components of the system secondarily. So our thought was that the Oregon Education Investment Board, which is looking at the system as a system, would be a good education authority for us to approach to get access to the data. So we drafted the bill this way, but it also had an efficiency measure to it, because if we are looking at multiple parts of the system, asking multiple parts for permission to get the data and then to get the data just was less efficient than getting a single permission and then going to the various entities to obtain the data. And we have been looking at the system in a couple different ways. Just a couple quick examples. We just issued an audit on adult GEDs, and what we found was students are falling through a gap in that they drop out from high school, and there really isn't a mechanism to reengage those adults in a process of getting a GED. So we made recommendations for what community colleges and K-12 schools could do to better communicate, better market that as an option. Secondarily, we also looked at the matchup between community colleges and their capacity to educate students in middle skill level jobs and the forecast that the employment department does in terms of future job needs, and found some mismatches there. Too many kids graduating in a particular field means they're going to have a real hard time getting a job. On the other hand, not enough kids means that businesses have a difficult time growing without that skilled labor force. So we're looking at places where the system can fit better together, and so it seemed to us natural that we would look at the Oregon Education Investment Board as an option to approach. So that was essentially what we wrote in this bill, and we would maintain this data like we do other very confidential data on children, health issues, juvenile justice issues, protecting it in a secure environment, destroying when it's not needed anymore for our audit, and reporting in a way that protects the anonymity of the students. So that was kind of the whole part of this bill, and I have the hope that we can continue forward with this. We're excited about the prospect of getting access to the data to start asking these big, meaningful questions about tracking students through a system and seeing what's working and what's not. So I would urge you to approve this measure.
You started off by saying there was a rule change. Could you explain how that...
They went through the full federal record in that they had hearings around the country that it eliminated that prohibition and instead provided that an education authority would approve access for auditors to do the analysis. So it was done at the federal level, and this, in seeing that change, we thought, let's get in line so that we have a process here in Oregon so that we can step up and have an education authority identified in order to have access to that data.
Okay. Senator Byers, do you have a question?
I guess I had a couple of questions, if I may. One, I'd like to be clear. Why does Secretary of State need access to school records, period? I thought mainly most of the school audits seem to be done by independent auditors with the reports made to Secretary of State as part of it. Second one is, if it makes sense for Secretary of State to have authority to go to student records rather than directing that to somebody else, why wouldn't we just put in the statute that you are allowed to have access?
Chair Haas, Senator Beyer, on the first part, the financial audits of the school districts are done by local CPA firms. My office does not get much involved in them on a financial level. They also look at compliance with federal rules. Mm-hmm. They aren't necessarily looking at the performance of those districts in terms of how successful they are at educating, how well they're coordinating with other aspects of the education system, what's happening to students from various demographic or socioeconomic strata, a variety of things that we could be looking at and figuring out what's working and what's not, make recommendations for improvement. The performance audits that we've been doing over the last 3.5 years ask more about the mission of the organization and what can be done to improve it. And it's a whole different kind of an approach. We're actually looking at clients in social services. We did an audit looking at the juvenile justice system to assess how consistently decisions were made to county.
So have you done performance audits of school district today?
We've done not of school districts, no. We have the school districts, I have done performance audits at the local level of school districts when I was the city auditor. We had an agreement with the school districts in Multnomah County. But it was very difficult. In fact, if I could, I'll give you an example. We were trying to determine how the lottery system they were using to assign children to different high schools. And they had set up a formula for giving benefit to lower income, disadvantaged youth to get a higher preference. We asked for the data. They said they couldn't give it to us. We asked them to clean all the identifiers out so that we could analyze scores and decisions, and we actually found an error in their formula, and the disadvantaged youth were being disadvantaged in the formula rather than advantaged. So those are the kinds of impacts that we can have if we can get at the student level. I don't envision something like that being done here from the Secretary of State's perspective, because that was really done in a particular district. But having student information gives us much more insight into what's working and what isn't.
Senator Roman.
So my question is, this is kind of a carte blanche, a waiver of kind of what we've held really tight to ourselves in that personally identifiable information.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate what you just said, because you said they gave us all the information that was not and scrubbed it so it wasn't personally identifiable. This will not be scrubbed, right? You'll have personally identifiable information at your access to do with as you do these performance audits. That makes me a little nervous. Are there protections to make sure that that personally identifiable information is not going to get out?
Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, yes, definitely. We, as I said, we maintain, in the course of our audits, we're looking at Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority data, which includes health data, and it's secured. We maintain, when we do our audit of the juvenile justice system, that's highly controlled and confidential data. That is protected and destroyed at the end of our audit. The same thing would apply here. And in fact, what this does call for as well is that for each time we request the data, we need authorization from the education authority. So it's not a carte blanche that we would simply be able to go at any point for any purpose. We would explain to them what we were doing with the data in order to go forward.
Hello. Senator Rubin?
So in your reading of the statutes in the formation of the OEIB, they have the authority to get that information and therefore to share it with you? At all levels, including higher ed, which we haven't really had before?
Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, it's my understanding that this would grant them the authority.
To OEIB?
To OEIB, to grant us the authority, because I don't know that there is an education authority defined in Oregon.
That's that's my concern, because we had individual school districts are very careful about sharing that information. I mean, as a high school principal, this is one of my biggest fears, was that information that would get out. And we did things to make sure that we gave a personally a number to each one of the kids so that the Department of Ed has it. But they have to come back to the school district to figure out who the kid is. So I am just very concerned that if we're going down a track that releases that information in ways that would make me very uncomfortable.
Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, I certainly understand and I share your concern about that information getting out. Okay. And we would provide every assurance that we do with the other confidential data we get. And in fact, if I could, one of the things that we stumbled on when we were working with Portland Public Schools, when they cleaned that data, they cleaned it wrong, and they gave us bad data, and we put a huge amount of work in only to discover that it was wrong. So for us to clean it allows us to at least be assured of it. And the first thing we did was stripped out the identifiers and used a number.
So the other question is, in the answer you just gave, you're basically saying that this bill will give OEIB the authority that they may not have had before to actually give you the authority to do it. So does that mean that they then have the authority to get this information from individual districts that they may or may not have had before this bill?
Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, I don't know that answer. It's a legal issue related to federal law, and I'm not going. I'm an auditor, not a lawyer.
Okay, fair enough. That's fair enough. Thank you,
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, you're tying all this to OEIB, which may or may not exist a couple years from now. Is there other sources you could get this from?
Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, yes, we could go to each of, I'm not sure if it's school districts or a Department of Education or each of the 17 community colleges or the 7 universities. Mm-hmm. So it's possible to do that. Again, this was an efficiency effort on our part, that going to one place that we could get that access, with the idea then we would contact whichever entities, education entities, we needed to get the actual data, was the approach that we thought would be most efficient.
Okay, but basically what we're doing here is we're taking control of the data one more step removed from source, correct? You have the ability to go to a school district or a community college or a university and request the information you need for an audit currently, right?
That's Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, yes.
Okay. Ms. Chair, this is uncomfortable, to say the least, that we'd be going this one step too far.
Yeah. Senator Rubble.
One more clarification. What you just answered makes me feel a little less nervous. If all you're asking OEIB for is permission to go to the others to do it, because that's what the federal government said, you had to ask some permission. But they're not going to have the information. You're still going to have to go to the others to get it. I feel a little more comfortable if you're just asking them for permission, if we're not asking them to give you the information. That makes me a little more comfortable. So I guess I'll have to read it again to know exactly which way it's going. Because if it is just a permission request, which gives you then the opportunity to go to those other places and get their information, I feel a little better.
If I could, Mr. Chair.
Senator Byer.
Okay. Okay. But what Senator Roblin said just actually confused me. Because quite simply, if we're doing this so that you can go to OEIB to get permission to go where you can currently go without going to OEIB, why would you be doing it?
Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, let me throw one other reason. Which is, as I said earlier, we're looking at gaps in the education system. When we completed the audit and pointed to the fact that there was a disconnect between the curricula and the community colleges and the Employment Department forecasts, we went to find out who would own that solution. No one owned it. We ended up going, and the governor's office responded to that audit because no one else owned it. That's the kind of place where if we can engage in those places where we think we find gaps, and have OEIB at least point to or negotiate with those other entities to say, okay, the auditor pointed out a problem here. Let's sort it out this way. Being able to have an entity that was over that and implement recommendations would, I think, help us in getting our audit done and also to follow up to see what had been done. That's another reason.
Senator Byer.
Back to the second part of my original question. If you convince us you need access to that information, why wouldn't we just grant you that statutory authority to get it?
Oh, I'm sorry. Chair Haas, Senator Byer, I forgot to answer that one. It's my understanding that an education authority has to grant it to us, that we can't. I actually pondered whether the legislature could be considered an education authority and you could grant it, but apparently the language in the federal law requires an education authority to grant access. So we can't just have it.
So the Board of Education has that authority now. Why wouldn't we just let them do that? And go to OEIB, which doesn't have any control.
Chair Haas, Senator Byer, because Department of Education doesn't have authority over the community colleges or the universities.
It does have community
colleges. Well, actually, community colleges.
Community colleges it does.
Oh, okay.
But not higher ed.
But not higher ed. Mm-hmm. There'd be two then. Chancellor's office.
We're going to spend more time on the one-page bill.
Technically, OEIB doesn't have any administrative authority over any of them.
That's That's right.
No.
You know, we all know what the end game here is. You have a long history of trying to find out who's accountable and on some of these policies. Yeah. Your history with the state and with the city of Multnomah County is a long list of achievements here. So while we may be uncomfortable, confused, and nervous, we're going to work with you on this, okay?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, because we know what the end game is. So thank you. And I'll call up next on the list is Morgan Allen.
I think he can end all our confusion.
That's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Oregon School Boards Association. And I'm going to stick to my original script because I'm a little bit more confused than I was before. But, you know, we understand that sometimes these records need to be accessed. So I don't think at this point, although I may rethink that after running through the testimony, I don't think we oppose the intent or the purpose of the bill, and we've communicated our concerns to the Secretary of State's office that we believe if there's a authorizing authority for K-12 records or K-12 audits, it should be the State Board of Education. And I'll give you just three quick reasons why. The first reason is under the current governance system, and even any of the proposed governance systems, the State Board of Ed is the policy and rulemaking board for the K-12 system. So they have the information and the knowledge about that. The second reason is the Department of Education has knowledgeable staff to deal with FERPA issues, and OEIB does not at this point. They're not set up to deal with FERPA issues. You know, they get all their data. My understanding is like when they do achievement compacts, they get all that data from the Department of Ed. So that's a second concern related to FERPA. And the third concern is specifically in Oregon statute right now, statute tasks the State Board of Education the State Board of Education specifically with adopting rules and standards around student records. So it makes sense that the people that set up the rules and regulations for student records should be the ones considering the requests to access those records. So we would, at minimum at this point, although again, we may want to rethink this, we'd recommend that the bill be amended to reflect these concerns and give the authority to the State Board, although it sounds like they may already have it. And just for sake of brevity, I'm up here on behalf of OSBA, COSA, OEA, and some others that are concerned with the bills. We thought we'd just send one person up, so.
And you do this first.
For brevity.
Questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Althea, what do you think? All right. Why don't we close the public hearing on Senate Bill 139 and revisit it possibly with some amendments down the road. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 105. Administrator Donovan, if you could give us a quick summary.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. Senate Bill 105 touches on education service district funding. We talked about education service districts at our last hearing this past Tuesday. Currently, the 19 education service districts throughout the state, along with the Office of Regional Education Services, are funded through a formula. Senate Bill 105 seeks to alter and amend that formula for the purposes of clarity and to resolve potential outstanding errors in the formula itself.
Okay, I'll call forward the Department of Education and panel of folks here. And just by way of perspective, this was an issue that arose out of the ESD Bill 250 in the last session. This particular part was what I might call the Frank Morse Amendment, that where we sought to set up an education czar and using some of the money from ESDs, and somebody's math added up to 100.25%, which is causing some of the problem here. And I'll let you further explain it. But thanks for.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. What is being handed out is two graphs of current funding and proposed funding of the Office of Regional Education.
Michael, start off by identifying
yourself.
Sorry,
I apologize. My name is Michael Elliott. I'm with the Department of Education. So the first part of the graph shows the current flow of Office of Regional Education Services and the Regional Education Services account. State and local revenue comes in, it goes to the state school fund formula, and then that is distributed into three pots: districts at 95.5%, ESDs at 4.5%, and the RESA, or Regional Education Services account, at 0.25%. If you add those up, you get 100.25% of available funding.
That's really good. Extra money to spend.
We like that. That's good. That's a good
yes,
way to get
we do
money.
Like that. However, since we cannot spend over 100%, we had to figure out how to fund the RESA. I apologize. I haven't done that quite good at accounting yet. So what we did was we funded the Regional Education Services account with school district funds and ESD funds at a rate of 95.5% coming from school districts and 4.5% coming from ESDs. This adds up to about between $10 and $11 million a year. Now, Senate Bill 250 states that the Office of Regional Education Services can only spend $500,000 a biennium to fund the office, and the rest of the money goes back to the school districts. So that's why you see that arrow, $500,000 going to the biennium to fund the Office of Regional Education Services, and then the rest going back to the school districts to be distributed through the school funding formula. What this means is that school districts give out about $10 million at the beginning of the year, and then at the end of the year they get it back. So it's a forced savings account, if you will. If you flip the page over, you see what Senate Bill 105 the goal of Senate Bill 105. That is to take state and local revenue, give it to the state school fund, we divide it as statute requires, 95.5 going to the districts, 4.5 going to the ESDs, which is 100%. The ESDs then fund the ESDs as well as give $500,000 straight to the Office of Regional Education Services. So it will still be coming out of the ESD share. There will no longer be a Regional Education Service account, but there will also not be this need to take money from the school districts and then give it back at the end of the year. So that is the goal of Senate Bill 105.
Okay. Cindy?
Chair Haas, Cindy Hunt, Government and Legal Affairs Manager for the Department of Education. I'm here if you have any questions regarding the implementation of Senate Bill 250.
Okay. Can you explain to me the issues regarding the $20 million? The money that was being withheld from schools, what problem, why that was being withheld?
Chair Haas, that was being withheld because, again, we have that 0.25 overage, so that money has to come from somewhere. So rather than, and the Senate Bill 250 did not give any indication where that money should come from. So we're withholding money from the school districts, and then the excess money goes back to school districts. So school districts, rather than having their $10 million a year throughout the year, are being forced to give it in May, and that does cause some problem for school districts because their budgets are based on getting the money all at once. Now they get this benefit at the end of the year where they may not be able to spend it, you know, on projects and stuff because it's at the end of the school year rather than the beginning of the school year.
And then when the RESA account was established that put roughly, you know, the $20 million into it, there wasn't any other uses for it that was designated by the legislature other than this Office of Regional Services that $500,000 could be used for. So essentially you have $19.5 million, I don't want to say just sitting there, but yeah, just sitting there. And so one of the purposes of the bill, in addition to fixing the 100.25% issue, is saying, you know, there's a cleaner way to do this.
And with respect to the ESDs, I know we tried unsuccessfully to recruit for that. And in effect, Rob Saxon has kind of just taken that on as he's stepped up.
Yeah, Chair Haas, members of the committee. So Senate Bill 250 last session also, there's this Office of Regional Education Services, and we call it the head of the office. We've kind of dubbed it the ESDSR. But what happened...
carries a sword and
wears a hat. Yeah, something like that. Crown, maybe, you know. So what happened was under the prior leadership of the department, we went out for two recruitments for the position that were national recruitments, and those were not successful for probably a variety of reasons. And then about the time we were getting ready to do a third recruitment, we had a significant leadership change.
And so then when Deputy Superintendent Rob Saxton came on, he basically took on the ESD issue himself. And so in addition to the task force that I know that you've heard him testify to and the recommendations that he personally administered and so forth, he's also traveled around the state and visited I don't know how many ESDs and school districts at this point, and certainly one of the topics of discussion is school districts' relationship with their ESD. So, you know, based on, I'm sure, what you've heard from him previously, he's very committed to, you know, examining issues relating to ESDs and school districts, and so that's how we've been handling it at this point.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Questions? Senator Roblin.
Two. The first one's kind of in jest, but they had $20 million sitting in the RESA account. Did they invest that and get some interest so we could get up to the 0.025 extra percent?
Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, I believe money sitting in Allstate's accounts gets invested by our treasurer. What I don't know for sure is if we got to retain that or if it just went into the general fund.
Okay. I'll have to check that one. So my other question is, does this bill, as you read it, do exactly what this chart says? Because I trust you, because I used to have you write these things. I'm just checking to see that you read it and it says what this is.
Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, yes, I believe it does.
Okay. Thank you. That's all.
We worked with her.
Yes, we did.
Still do sometimes.
So we.
Do you have the paper?
No, I think we need to think about this as a committee as to whether we want to continue forward with this ESDZR in the light of some other changes. Senator Roblin.
Yeah, question about that one. Is the office still important, even if he's doing the job? Sometimes the money can be used to do expedite things and have people that are looking over the ESDs, and I'm not sure that's a bad idea. So I think you still do have some personnel that are still doing this, right, work?
Yeah, Senator Haas, Senator Roblin, that's correct. I mean, in addition to, you know, Deputy Superintendent Saxton, we've had other personnel that have dedicated some time to ESD work. And as far as moving forward, I think it largely depends on the policy decisions, you know, of the legislature, and obviously this is very much in play.
Right, and we had him in the last week on ESDs, and you're right, he's been doing a lot of work on this.
Yeah.
And we've got some legislation that he worked on that is in the hopper now, and we, in addition to the bill we passed, we're looking at, you know, a long-term study, and I don't think we've kind of settled on a direction yet. So before we do this bill, we might want to get some of those other issues.
I agree. Yes,
yeah,
but this might be a good place to
have
some of that go to.
So, thank you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you for your help at all our town halls in Beaverton. And
you're welcome.
And some of you might be interested to know that if you need a guy to come to walk your constituents through school funding and the labyrinth of complexity there, that he is superb. I will close the hearing on Senate Bill 105, and Senator Close is here, and we are going to open a simultaneous public hearing on SB 500 and SJR 23. So Senator Close, would you like to come forward?
Thank you very much, Chair Haas, and of course, Vice Chair Canope, who is not here, but members of the committee. I really appreciate you hearing Senate Bill 500 and Senate Joint Resolution 23. These bills are about giving every child in Oregon access to a high-quality education. Senate Bill 500 creates a tax credit for educational expenses or for contributions to a qualified scholarship-granting organization. It is a $1,000 credit per child if the taxpayer is a parent. It can be adjusted by the Department of Revenue for cost of living adjustments. That would be computed annually, may be carried forward and offset by next year's taxes. It talks about non-residents in the bill if they follow the existing ORS. It does not take effect without Senate Joint Resolution 23, which would be a referendum to the people. The reason that's in there is there's some question about whether it's constitutional. Our Oregon Constitution says that you can't take money out of the Oregon Treasury for private schools, but this would not be in the Treasury. So we've gone ahead and included the referral to the people to change the Constitution if that's deemed necessary. Whatever the committee would choose on that would be fine with me. This is a good bill, colleagues. 13 other states have followed this path, including these very varied states from Arizona, where both individuals and corporations are allowed a tax credit. They offered $17 million in 2010. They also have a tax credit for special needs. Also Florida, Virginia, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, and as I said, 13 total. Lastly, I want to make it clear that this is not just a tax credit to pay for private school, or private tuition, as some have said. I actually woke up, I have my radio turned to the local radio station, and that's what was said this morning on the radio. It's a $1,000 credit, and that would, of course, only pay for 2 months at many private schools. It's much more than that. It gives parents choice and flexibility. We all want the best education for our children. So I hope that these bills will spark a discussion about giving parents and kids more educational choices. Thank you.
Thank you. I know we have some questions, Senator. I guess I would start with, do you have a revenue figure on this and what this would cost?
I do not have a revenue figure at this time. We can get that if you would so desire.
Okay. Further questions, Senator Robuck?
So would you cap the tax credit, or would it be available to any and all? So if you cap it at a certain number, that will give me a somewhat of an idea what the revenue impact would be.
That is true. Some of the states I was reading about, and I can get the copy of what I took off the Internet about what other states have done, they did have caps.
Follow-up? Senator Robuck. Regardless of what it is, so I really understand why 23 is here, because I believe that if, in fact, you did not have a constitutional change, this is against our Constitution. There is not a federal tax credit to this kind at this time, I don't think.
There is a federal tax credit for college tuition.
Okay.
Which grateful for.
Okay.
So there is some precedence.
So when it comes to the separation of state and church, I mean, we're basically saying that with this tax credit, we would allow, let's say we cap it at $10 million, just for the conversation. $10 million would be, therefore, going to private schools, some of which be religious, some are not, but it would definitely cloud the whole idea of separation of church and state with respect to money. So I understand this one. It also means that that's X number of dollars, and I guess I'm asking you to agree or not, that wouldn't go to education for the kids in the regular public schools, because it's going to have to come from somewhere.
Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, we have Pell Grants, federal grants, that can be used at any institution the parent or student decides. We're generally a nation of faith, different faiths, but I don't think that should preclude taxpayers of faith from educating their children the way they would see fit. So I guess I would disagree a little bit about we're not promoting religion, we're promoting educational choice. I'm an example of someone who used, with my children, I was a homeschooler for many years. Then they went to the local public school and took courses there while they were half-time homeschoolers. So then the school received state money for the time that they were there. Actually, students that go out of schools and to private schools actually benefit because they're still getting the property tax from their district for those students, but the student is not costing them anything. So there's sort of a wash here, I would say.
He gave a follow-up. I agree. I mean, I understand those, and I have a lot of friends and others who have gone to private schools, and their parents have paid that, and they got a great education. So I have absolutely no problem with that. But we have a law in our state that says they have to go to compulsory education. That's why college is a little different. That's choices. Compulsory education, and in our state, at least till 16 or finishing the 10th grade. I mean, there are reasons why when we start going this route that we are, because it is compulsory. The parents can choose to go to wherever they want, but they have to be in school in certain years. Homeschooling is the kind of the little disjoint from that, but there are reasons for doing that. So I worry about this as a bigger precedent than giving it to colleges and other places, because it's something that we're requiring all citizens and their kids to do. So it's harder for me. I just want you to know that.
I appreciate that, Chair Haas, Senator Roblin. The compulsory school attendance exemptions in the statute are under ORS 339.030. I know it well because I was a homeschooler.
Yeah. Yep.
But it does give exemptions from the compulsory school attendance, and that would be, of course, the private schools, homeschools, emancipated minors, people working full-time. We do have some exemptions.
Yes, we do. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Close, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Steve Buckstein.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Steve Buckstein. I'm senior policy analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy research center in Portland. And I'm here to testify in favor of both SB 500 and SJR 23. I've got a couple points, and I'll add a couple based on the discussion that we just had in terms of funding and constitutionality. First, I think we need, many people don't know that Oregon was sort of in the forefront of some of these issues back in 1922, when an initiative was placed on the ballot, supported by the Ku Klux Klan, which was active in the state then, and it passed, and it banned all private education in the state. It was a blatantly anti-Catholic, racist measure, and before it could take effect, two schools sued the governor, and the U.S. Supreme Court in 1925 ruled to strike down this measure. So it never took effect in Oregon. And the key, it was a long ruling, but the key sentence I want to read to you in the Supreme Court decision prohibiting private education in the state. Quote, "The child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his destiny have the right, coupled with the high duty, to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations," unquote. Coming forward, in 2009, Cascade and the Friedman Foundation National Group contracted with a national polling firm to do a scientific poll of Oregon likely voters to see where they stood on a number of educational issues in the state of Oregon. They polled 1,200 likely Oregon voters. 83% of those likely voters had children in K through 12 schooling. In Oregon at the time. There were a number of findings, but the key finding from my standpoint was that while in 2009, and maybe a tad bit lower now, but in 2009, 91% of Oregon families sent their children to regular public schools, not charter schools, but regular, quote-unquote, public schools. According to the survey, only 13% might have done so if they had been able to exercise a real choice. 87% wished that they had another option or multiple options besides sending their child to the local public school. Again, we only have about 9 or 10% that are sending their children elsewhere, actually about 13% when you include homeschooling, other alternatives. But still, the vast majority send their children to regular public school. But my caveat is don't be fooled by that, again, because I think there are reasons why they do that. The main reason is that most people can't afford to pay the taxes to support the public schools and the tuition for private school at the same time. So they're stuck. If 87% want that option, only about 13% have been able to exercise that option in Oregon so far. We spend in Oregon more than $5 billion tax dollars every year, $10 billion a biennium, including what the legislature grants, local property taxes, federal money, all tax money more than $5 billion a year to educate Oregon's K through 12 students. And yet virtually every dollar of that goes to public schools and the adults who work in those public schools. And my question is the money meant to support those public schools and the employees, or is it meant to educate children? They're not necessarily the same thing, as we know from the dropout rate and achievement data that we're all concerned about. So I think we have to look at that and say, is there a way to better educate children with that money? Allowing up to a $1,000 tax credit, as SB 500 allows, is really a small step. The NEA determined, there's all kind of numbers, but in 2010 that we were spending in Oregon over $11,300 in all funds to educate K through 12 students. This bill would allow up to a $1,000 tax credit, which I think is a relatively small step towards giving parents the ability, as the Supreme Court said they should have, the duty and the right and the obligation to raise their children for future obligations. And we know from at Cascade, we've run since 1999 a small private scholarship program. No tax money. We don't take any overhead from it. All donations from the private sector to educate several hundred low-income kids, all below the federal free lunch guideline. And we only supply or only provide on average about half the tuition. And these parents have sacrificed, they've got second jobs, they have found other educational opportunities for their children with a small amount of help. It's not to say, in fact, when we surveyed them, they didn't say that the local public school was terrible. They said they wanted something better for their children. And that's what this bill would allow. It's not saying that there's anything wrong with the current public schools. It's not saying that parents should send their children somewhere else. It's just giving them the choice. In terms of the finances, we actually did an analysis of a somewhat similar bill in 2009 that's now outdated because it had some other aspects. But at that point, talking about the break-even point, only about 9% of children in the public schools would have to move. And that was including up to a $10,000 corporate tax credit, which is not part of this bill. So my assumption is, and again, if this gets to Ways and Means, you know, we'd be happy to help provide that data and look at what the break-even point would be. But basically, with a relatively small percentage of students taking advantage of this, you could actually very easily be left with more money per child in the remaining public school system. In terms of the constitutionality, I know Senator Close wants to be safe by amending Article 1, Section 5. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2002 in the Zelman case there was a voucher program in Cleveland that was challenged on federal constitutional grounds, and the vast majority of the parents took that voucher and went to religiously affiliated schools, and the Supreme Court found that that was constitutional. They have a five-part test, which, again, doesn't directly relate to Oregon, but we're pretty sure it relates closely enough that this would be constitutional because it's the parents making the decision. The money doesn't go through the Treasury. And it's not to benefit religious schools, it's to benefit the children, which if that's what the $5 billion we're spending per year is meant to do, it should satisfy that test. So with that, I urge you to consider supporting SB 500 and SJR 23. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Buckstein? Thank you, sir. I'm going to bring up people two at a time here. So let's start with Brenda Libby and Marcia Kelly. Yes, I said. I meant to say Breda Libby.
Breda.
That's what I meant. That's what I said. Breda.
We got it now.
Sorry.
And you said somebody else.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Start with your
okay.
name.
Okay, Senator Haas, Chairman, distinguished legislators. I drove my son to school for 6.5 years every day because I wanted him to get a better education.
Breda, start off with your name and your identification.
Breda Libby. I drove my son, like I said, every day for 6.5 years to a charter school because I ultimately, as a parent, wanted to make sure my son got the best education. As a parent, I know that I did the right thing because my son has achieved greatly. We can no longer continue to not take and give parents options. We absolutely must accommodate the parents that want to be a participant in their child's education. I think the $1,000 tax credit is a good way to go because it's going to start us having discussions about what is a good education versus just a education in general. This is a tool for us as a parent to be a participant. And trust me, there is no greater thing in the world than watching your child grow, learn, and achieve. We must take and start doing things differently. It's going to take all of us, and everybody's going to have to get involved. We cannot continue to stumble down this road where our public schools, we keep throwing more and more money at them, and they're not taking and giving, getting, or putting the kids out so that they can take and get good jobs, so that they can take and have better futures, so there can be more revenue flowing into the state. It's time to start looking at new alternatives. And I think that this bill is a test. It's a way for us to go forward. We need to take and start looking at different solutions. Obviously, the status quo has not worked. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Roman.
I just want to make sure that the charter school, took your son to a charter school?
Yes.
So it was a public charter school?
Well, it was a public charter school. It was the Optimum Learning Center in Kaiser, Oregon. My son went there, and when he was in third grade, what I had been saying to the school administrators at his previous school was I wanted him tested because he had some learning disabilities. The first thing that happened when he went to the Optimum Learning Center is they tested him. They found it out he needed LRC,
okay.
And a program was put together specifically for him. Out of that, by the time he reached eighth grade, he was an honor roll student. Had I not taken him out of that school and drove him those miles, my son might not have been an honor student.
I personally work hard for a charter school movement. I think it's a good thing. And it is, you didn't pay tuition there, right?
No, sir, okay. I didn't.
Okay,
but the thing of it is, that was my,
no
that
choice.
Was the alternative.
Alternative you had available, yeah.
Yes.
Thank
if,
you.
If I would have had a different one, I might have looked at
yeah. the other. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Marcia Kelly.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly. I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. We have approximately 100,000 members nationwide, about 2,000 in Oregon, counting members who are members at large and only members of the state. AUW of Oregon opposes Senate Bill 500. While we support education for all, we feel that creating tax credits for educational expenses or contributions to a qualified scholarship granting organization is not the way to go. At this point in time, we are struggling to fund our education system to the level that we know the educational system needs to be funded, and creating a tax credit for educational expenses or qualified scholarship granting organizations undermines the K-12 budget. Oregon dollars should not be spent on private tutors, private schools, or homeschooling expenses. Those families who choose alternate means of educating their children have chosen that. We believe free public education is the foundation of a democratic society. Our 1937A AUW legislative program called for free public instruction of high quality available to all, since popular education is the basis for freedom and justice. Our current policy states AUW's opposition to the use of public funds for non-public elementary and secondary education and to charter schools that do not adhere to the same civil rights and accountability standards as required of other public schools. We are not in favor of either Senate Bill 500 or SJR 23. And I think that if you look at the bill on page 2, line 8, and on line 14, you will find that there are corporate tax credits in this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Becky Stokes. There she is.
Hi. Good afternoon. Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come testify this morning. Becky Strauss, on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I am here to testify in opposition to SJR 23. We oppose any constitutional amendment that would result in the payment of tax funds to private religious schools. Amending Article 1, Section 5 of the Oregon Constitution in this way is inconsistent with the strong tradition of separation of church and state that has existed in Oregon since the Constitution was written in 1857. Oregon has been very lucky to avoid the disputes over aid to religious schools that we've seen in other states, and we've done so because the authors of the Oregon Constitution wanted to create a more complete separation of church and state than existed in any other state constitution at that time, really designed to keep church and state separate and designed to keep those functions from influencing the other. For this reason, the Oregon Constitution does contain the strongest provisions for separation of church and state of any other state in the nation. To address some of the points that have been raised by prior witnesses, the amendment proposed by SJR 23 would change that intent, would change the result of the founders' intent. SJR 23, if passed and then approved by the voters, would amend Article 1, Section 5 to include the clause, an income or excise tax credit may be allowed for educational expenses paid to or for the benefit of a religious-based school or non-sectarian school. Use of a tax credit, in our view, does not change the discussion or our position in regard to the strict separation of church and state. We do not believe that the distinction between a payment from the Treasury on the one hand and being excused from making an otherwise mandatory payment to the Treasury on the other really carries any constitutional significance. And actually, the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed with us in a case called Mueller v. Allen from 1983. And the court recognized that state tax policies such as tax deductions, exemptions, and tax credits are a means of, quote, channeling state assistance, end quote, to private organizations, which can have an economic effect comparable to that of aid given directly to an organization. So just in sum, we do oppose any effort to amend Article 1, Section 5 to dismiss the wisdom of the authors of our state constitution. They were well aware of the dangers of sectarian strife, and they wrote a constitution that was empathetic in its insistence on separation of church and state. Adoption of SJR 23 would reverse 154 years of Oregon history and would overturn a constitutional principle that has served the state well since that time. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Mel Conrad and Carla K. Edwards.
Do you want to go or do you want
to go?
Thank you, Senator Haas. and Chair Haas and fellow senator committee members. My name is Carla K. Edwards. I am here on behalf both of Americans for Prosperity, but more importantly, on behalf of a mother with a kindergartner. School choice is imperatively important and has become an important policy position for Americans for Prosperity just recently, quite frankly. We've been working on it, and we've actually raised it to a level of importance because we do believe that this is a vital, important thing that economically really needs to be worked out, and that where free market principles could be applied to really raise the boat on all aspects of education, both publicly and privately. Just a quick fact that based on inflation-adjusted spending per student has nearly doubled in the last 90 years, yet student performance has remained flat nationwide. There is a desperate need for an insurgence of school choice and the ability for parents to make a competitive environment so that children get the best education important. As a parent, I want to give you my personal story and my personal example of why this is so important. I have a child that is in the Sheridan Wilhelmina School District. That is a very rural school district with a high population. So we chose to register my daughter for kindergarten and went to the registration. It was amazing to me the number of kids in a two-hour registration window that was coming through that school and signing up for kindergarten. What was very apparent is that there were a number of parents that never had a choice of where their children will go. Our closest, if you wanted to do an inter-district transfer, our closest transfers would be Dallas or McMinnville, 25 miles away on both ends. So their only choice was Wilhelmina-Sheridan School District, or if you had an opportunity to go to a private school. Many of those people in that rural district do not have the economic ability to pay for private schools, though there are private schools very close. This would provide an opportunity for those parents to consider that opportunity to take their children out of that very crowded district and allow them to get an education in a private school. That is what my husband and I did because we had the means to be able to do that and provide that to our child when we saw the huge number of registrations for kindergarten and what potentially would happen with her education at a very critical time. It was sad to see that most of those people in my community did not have that opportunity. And SB 500 and SJ 23 would be a first step in an opportunity potentially to provide those people and those families with at least a choice of where they sent their children.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Chair Haas and the rest of the board. My name is Mel Conrad, and I represent, I guess, myself as a taxpayer and as a private property owner. The reason I make the distinction, of course, is because my tax money income taxes have gone to supply revenue in the general fund and other places for the school funding, aside from the property taxes. I wanted to just share the rest of the story, if I might, as Paul Harvey would have put it. 19 years ago, after raising my first family, I was given the opportunity of adopting two of my grandchildren. These were very fragile children that had shaky, shattered beginnings. I thought it best for them to have the flexibility that they enjoy a small class size with much greater parent or teacher-student relationship than would ordinarily be available in a much larger public school setting. Over the years, I did bear the cost, not only of my taxes going to the regular income taxes and property taxes, but I also was so committed to the welfare of these children. And by welfare, I mean the end result, not public welfare. I might say that I adopted these children. They were never on public assistance at any time. That did result in a choice It was expensive to pay the taxes, to pay for other children's school that I was not sending these children to. I did send them to a private school. They both graduated. One has already graduated from Western Oregon University in public health education. And so the outcomes have been very strong in both these cases. I urge you to be in support of Senate Bill 500 because it gives people like me and all other parents opportunities and flexibility to make choices that benefit the specific fragility of children that come from challenged beginnings. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And those kids are blessed by having a grandmother take up that role. Do we have any questions? Okay, thank you, Ms. Edwards. I love the way you say kindergarten. That's the way my wife says it, too. If there's no one else to come forward on Senate Bill 500 and Senate SJR 23, then I'm going to close the public hearing. And I might just say I very much appreciate the politeness of which we can debate sometimes contentious issues. One final piece of housekeeping before we adjourn and the introduction of a committee bill here. Senator Canoe, if you take that motion.
Chair Hass, yeah, I'd like to, but before I do that, I just wanted to, for the record, a lot of people have come up and they're confused about the pronunciation of your name, sir. And just for the record, you know, and no offense to anybody, his name is Hass. And the reason I bring this up is because people keep calling him Haas. And I'm concerned that being the vice chair of this committee, that they're going to start referring to me as Little Joe. So I think it's just important that we clarify for everybody that the committee chair's name is Hass, and that way, you know, as people come in, maybe they'll pick that up, and we won't have this problem in the future.
Yeah. Would that make Lee then Adam?
It might. Yeah. It might. You know, he could be the papa, right? Old Lauren Green now.
I'm saying Little Joe. Yeah.
So. Okay. We are really dating ourselves with the name.
But Chair Hass, I move that the following LC be introduced as a committee bill, LC 2123, dated 9/25/12.
Yes. Sorry. Let me open a work session.
Awesome.
Go ahead.
Chair Hass, I move the following LC be introduced as a committee bill, LC 2123, dated 9/25/12.
Senator Canoe moves that the following LCs be introduced, LC 2123, dated 9/25/12. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none? So ordered. With no other business before us, we'll adjourn.
Very good.